Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 22nd of September 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, is Mike Robinson. And we are joined today by David Scott, Northern Exposure. And of course, David reporting, amongst other things, on matters north of the border. Well, I think we should get straight into the snake lady.
Treason in Florence today, Brian.
Treason
in Florence. Of course, Theresa May is in Florence meeting with political leaders, national leaders from various European Union countries, because she says she wants to try, well, the indications are that she wants to try to bypass the European Commission with regard to Brexit negotiations, this charade of Brexit negotiations. She's there to make some offers. And see whether she can get some support from national leaders. So the Lancaster House speech moves to the Santa Maria Novella in Florence. What's she talking about? Recognition that a two-year transition deal is going to be required. So that means that basically Brexit will come to a stop for 2 years while there's a transition process which goes on, and that's going to be required after 2019. So already Brexit is pushed out from March 2019 to March 2021, if she makes this offer, which looks like she's going to do. There are going to be 20 billion euros worth of payments made, she's going to make citizens' rights have direct effect in UK courts. So she's moving them out of the realm, or she's attempting to move them out of the realm of the European court, European courts into British courts, but basically it'll be the same deal. She's going to say, if we can do that, then when this chapter of our European history is written, it will be remembered not for the differences we faced, but for the vision we showed, not for the challenges we endured, but for the creativity that we used to overcome them, not for a relationship that ended with a new partnership. A new partnership that began. So again, we've got this language from Theresa May and the British government. Brexit is not about leaving anything. It's about entering a new thing. And that new thing, of course, is going to be exactly the same as the old thing. But that's another story. While the UK's departure from the EU is inevitably a difficult process, it is in all of our interests, she said, for negotiations to succeed. So I believe we share a profound sense of responsibility to make this change work smoothly and sensibly, not just for people today, but for the next generation who will inherit the world we leave them. The eyes of the world are on us. But if we can be imaginative and creative about the way we establish this new relationship. So new relationship, that's what it's all about, Brian.
And that statement is a killer, Mike, because we've got to be imaginative and creative. Why have we got to be imaginative and creative? Because the eyes of the world are on us. So what she's really saying is we're being watched. We know we're being watched very carefully. So we can't be truthful. Mm. We've got to start using creative, manipulative, misleading language in order to stitch up this new partnership with the European Union. Mm. So we'll say that it was, of course, only the UK column that started to talk about Brexit being a complete psyop, is what you called it in the beginning, Mike. And we've been proved 100% right. There is no Brexit.
And anybody that's paying attention may have noticed that Michael Heseltine making some comments about this in the last couple of days, saying that, in his opinion, Brexit probably isn't going to happen. And in fact, more than that, Britain will eventually join the euro.
Yeah.
So perhaps that leads into what we're about to discuss.
So we've got British Prime Minister openly saying the intention is to deceive the nation. That brings us straight back to Ted Heath, because of course all the evidence was there that Ted Heath, together with his Tory government, deliberately misled the nation into the start of the whole procedure. And that is why at the moment that the Wiltshire police investigation into Ted Heath as a possible paedophile starts to really show us how the politics have been manipulated. And I will ask the question, was Prime Minister Ted Heath blackmailed over the subject of the abuse of children? Right. Well, let's follow on with Brexit. We've got more proof that the thing is not working. The Major General, the Commandant General of the Royal Marines, McGowan, has been tweeting. This is his tweet. It's not very clear from the screenshot, but he says, "Delighted to welcome Director General of the EU Military Staff, Lieutenant General Polkinen, to #OpAtlantaHQ to discuss counter-piracy ops transition planning." And the next part of this is that our very own David Ellis tweeted, "This photo is of the EU C3 military HQ, #RN, #HQ, #Northwood, isn't it?" So David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives put the question directly to the Commandant General of the Royal Marines. This is the EU military HQ in Northwood, London. David Ellis went on to say the others are in Paris, Potsdam, and Greece. And he identifies that this has been mentioned by veterans for Britain and Admiral Philip Jones. And then we get a further response from the Major General, and he says that is correct. So there is no doubt now that what we've got is the full EU military C3 command, control, and communications has now been fully integrated into the British national structure. And so we have here in front of us EU military unification, Mike, and we've got the head of the Royal Marines casually, almost in an arrogant, joking way, I think, confirming it. So once again, we can demonstrate that particularly the Conservative government simply lying and lying and lying again to the general public in Britain over this subject of EU military unification. It's happened. And if you want a little bit of other proof here, Financial Times article, Britain is now willing to pay into the quote 5.5 billion euro EU defence fund. So BBC sort of also followed this up with the Prime Minister was to make the EU an open and generous offer. So the whole picture is here. We are locking things together. We've already locked the military together. We just need the treasury. But as supposedly the front end is Brexit. So we better drop in Brexit. What Brexit?
Yes, and let's bring David Scott into the programme at this point, because David, as the Irish Times is pointing out here, Brexit, of course, being used to drive a number of different policy agendas, and one which seems to be continuing to bubble under the surface is this whole issue of the Northern Irish border and British-Irish relations. So, what are the main points they're making here?
Yeah, this is showing that whether Brexit is real, and I'd like to come back to that in a moment, or how real it actually is, notwithstanding, the political statement from it is having profound repercussions all around the world. It's changing how people view many, many things. And this has been most quickly brought to light in Ireland. The Irish Times here says that the inescapable impression is of two friends steadily growing apart. For 40 years, Dublin has looked to London as its closest ally on the issues that mattered most. Now it finds itself sitting across the table with the EU27 seeking to its position itself with new alliances for a new era. So the geopolitical move is that Ireland, it would appear, is going to remain locked in to a European superstate. It looks like they're making that decision. That's the drift just now, and that even with all the compromises about Brexit, the position taken by the British people is putting a pull that's taken Britain into a much more independent position against the will of its establishment and of its politicians, despite everything they are trying to do, and that other nations are having to respond accordingly.
Yes, well, I mean, we wait to see what the implications of that are. All kinds of nonsense being talked regarding setting up borders between Northern Ireland and the UK and the mainland of the UK. This issue, of course, has broader implications, and part of it's being driven, of course, because some people are saying that situation is so untenable over the Northern Irish border that there actually can't be a Brexit.
Well, I mean, yes, but we've muddled past before with the Northern Irish border, and the idea that would derail Brexit, I don't think, is sustainable. What it might well do, though, is destabilise the island of Ireland, and that could be very grim indeed.
Yeah.
Can I just come briefly back to the report you started off with? $20 billion.
Yes.
$20 billion. Is that euros or pounds?
Euros.
Euros. Well,
not that it makes any difference anymore.
What difference does it make anymore? $20 billion. That's something like 6 years of contributions to the EU from Britain. So we are paying upfront for 6 years to get out, and then, well, what after that? What will happen? We'll go back in and join the euro. It's a very strange figure. Why on earth would we pay that? What is that? Is that 6 years from 2019 or from 2021? When are we actually free from the requirement to pay into this?
David, with a smile on my face, I have to interject and say, but we're not going to become free because there is no intention. The only way we're going to become free is when the wider British public say that they've had enough of this scam by Theresa May's Tory government.
Yeah, look, what's actually going on here is that we're moving from a position where we're members of the European Union to a position where we're members of the European Union, but it's going to be a transition period between those two forms of membership. And in the meantime, we're going to pay this 20 billion euros to make sure that everybody's sweet while this transition's happening. But where we're going to end up, I believe, and I think we probably all will agree on this, is that the new relationship that we end up with the European Union will be one where defence union is at the centre, fiscal union is going to be at the centre, where it's going to be a new European Union, a new European Union which has experienced a renaissance, and it's going to be a full federal situation. It's not going to be what we've got at the moment. So we are transitioning into something, but it's not Brexit.
And to finish the process, they simply need to get rid of Westminster in its present form, and that's already, of course, under discussion. And the rise of the city states and the power given to individual states, city states, is going to help that process. We better move on.
We better move on. My point is the
20 billion gives some sort of indication of what the timeline is.
Absolutely.
Because when does 20 billion equal our current contributions? That might be an interesting date to calculate.
Absolutely. So let's move on then to Israel. And this is Jerusalem Post. Former CIA officer blames Jews for America's wars. What's going on here, David?
This is fascinating. It's very interesting how this developed as well. Valerie Plame Wilson is a former CIA officer. Now, she was the one that was outed. She was involved in the litigation over Scooter Libby. She was outed by Armitage of the Bush White House. Her CIA status was revealed. She sued. She didn't get anywhere. There's been a film. So she's quite famous. She's tweeted out this link from an alternative news website who publishes things the mainstream media won't touch. And it is American Jews are driving America's wars. And this has been characterized as anti-Semitic by the Jerusalem Post. Bear in mind that the word has changed meanings. Anti-Semite used to be someone who hates Jews. Now it's someone Jews hate. It's become a slur word, an attack word. And she then had to kind of roll back from this. So she started off defending her position. She started off to say, read this article, it's worth a read. She then said, it's not an endorsement, but she encouraged people to put aside their biases and think clearly. Now, the reason she was asking them to think clearly is the position is this. You have a people, you have the American Jewish lobby well represented in the corridors of power. Particularly in the neocon movement, right? And the neocons are still, even in the Bush, they were strong in the Bush White House, but they're still strong in the Trump White House. They have shared citizenship. they have some degree of shared loyalty, and they're driving American foreign policy in the Middle East. And the position that the article makes is quite clear. It's arguing that they should recuse themselves because they have a vested interest. So she started off with that and then had to say, I'm of Jewish descent, because as she was attacked for saying this. And then she had to basically apologise and say, oh, I'm very sorry, I skimmed the piece, I zeroed in, I didn't understand the gross undercurrents. And she had to essentially backtrack. Now, the original article is on a unz.com. It's called America's Jews Are Driving America's Wars. Some of the tone, I must admit, I'm not particularly keen on, but it makes this point that the Jewish lobby has got split loyalties, and that is a significant problem for American foreign policy development in the Middle East.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for that. Now, let's move on to Scottish news, and we're going to start off with some video clips that you've been tweeting out with regard to Antifa operating in Scotland, in Perth, in fact. And you're asking in this first one, why the mask?
Yes, I asked this gentleman here why the mask. I asked several people why the mask. I didn't get an awful lot of clarity in a response. So this was in the streets of Perth a week and a half ago. It was there was a small march by the Scottish Defence League, who were protesting immigration and the construction of a mosque. This gentleman here in a mask, I understand, is actually a member of the Scottish Defence League, because he showed up later in their pen in the town centre. And I went round and I asked, this is the SDL protest. This is quite a small protest. There's maybe, 70 people there or something. And there was a couple of hundred counter-protesters, including maybe 50 or 60 Antifa. And there was a lot of shouting and very heavy police presence, about 300-400 police keeping very good order just as well. And so that was, the police are kettling a group of Antifa at this point. The Antifa were all masked, they were wearing black, they were carrying this the Antifa flag you see there, which is the flag of the German Communist Party from 1933, so that's encouraging. And I was there to ask questions and trying to find out what was motivating these people. So if people would search out these tweets, you'll find some interesting video. Here you see there's a masked man there with a balaclava helmet carrying the Irish tricolour as part of this. So there is a kind of Republican anti-British element that's playing into this far-left political stance. So I was there trying to find out as much as possible what these people believe. I managed to speak to a few of the Antifa with their masks, but off camera. They wouldn't even agree to speak to me on camera. That discussion very quickly showed them to be extreme left-wing, left-wing anarchists, communist anarchists, who basically hold there's no such thing as law and would be adamantly opposed to anything such as the common law, which governs our relationships with one another. And concepts such as cause no loss or harm are things that they oppose most vehemently. So it was interesting to see what we're facing, but it's a very extreme strand of thought that's rearing its head there.
Okay, and staying with Scotland then for a minute, your good lady wife has been published again in Third Force News. Is that the correct title? I think it is.
Yes, Third Force News. This is it looks at everything to do with the charitable sector in Scotland. It's a very good online paper, and this is my wife here is describing her freedom of information battle with the Scottish government to find out what was happening in their intense engagement over the named person. So they're intensely engaging with everyone who, apart from those who disagreed with them.
David, sorry, just before we move on, just quickly remind everybody what the named person legislation was about.
Yes, named person, and the fight goes on named person, is the idea that the state should appoint a guardian for each child in Scotland, essentially from birth or conception. It's slightly vague. They're moving around there until they're 18, or if they've been in care, 26, and that this person will be in their words, a sort of head gardener. The child is a delicate flower. All of the adults, there's no distinction between parents and non-parents, all of the adults in the child's lives are like gardeners that look after this delicate flower. But the named person, that they're the head gardener, and they're there to gather information on something called well-being, which can't be defined, And if they feel so motivated, share that information. And if they feel so motivated, summon up the various powers of the state to intervene. It is a complete refutation of any sort of independence, freedom, liberty or privacy in the family, and is possibly the most totalitarian thing ever written in the English language. There is, I'm pleased to say, strong and growing opposition to this, but it goes on. Now, what we found, what Leslie found, when she asked for this information is, there was no response, and then they said, well, we're going to publish it. But what was published wasn't minutes. It was summaries written of the meeting outcomes. So it was heavily edited, and there were no minutes. It then transpired that these meetings were part of larger meetings involving the state, many major charities, and there were no minutes. So there's very clearly considerable state business being done with no minuted record at all. And things like concerns, reservations, etc., which were voiced at these meetings, are not minuted and are not recorded in the meeting summaries. All that's in the meeting summary is the outcome the state wants to have recorded for posterity. So what we're seeing is state business being conducted in secret.
Yes. Okay. Very dangerous stuff. Okay. Let's just have a quick reminder. AV 8.1, the interim alternative view event is taking place in the Connaught Rooms in London on Sunday, the 8th of October. Brian will be speaking at that. Patrick Henningsen, Dr. Graham Downing. I did that yesterday as well. I do apologise, Graham. And Ian R. Crane speaking at that. And then remind everybody that Froome Stop War holding their media on trial event in London at the Bloomsbury Central Baptist Church on the 19th of October. John Pilger headlining that with Peter Ford, Patrick Henningsen, Vanessa Bailey and a number of others. Get along to those events if you can.
And we need to get the media on trial.
We absolutely do. Now, speaking of the media, let's just bring this in. Long-form digital journalism. This is on the PA website, and it's a course which is being run throughout September for a number of weeks. It says, compelling long-form stories make some of the web's most engaging content. In these 8 sessions, ambitious feature writers and those wanting to make the most of opportunities of digital long-form will discover the techniques they need to develop, produce and pitch their stories. So I just thought I would just briefly run through this webpage so you get a feeling for what is going on here. The tutor for this course is a guy called Giles Wilson. He set up the acclaimed BBC News magazine and also launched Well Told, the UK's first conference in long-form and narrative journalism. And some of the course material here for week one, they're discussing what's good. Week two, they're discussing how to select stories. We're going to come on to that in a second. Week three is about various platforms for publishing. Week four, ethical issues, including fact and fiction, how to draw the line in the right place. So this is long-form journalism is what this is supposed to be talking about. And now we're talking about bringing fiction into the mix. And this is quite an interesting thing, as we'll see in a second. Analytics, because long-form journalism, they're absolutely keen to make sure that people are tracked in what they read, how much of the article they read, which particular parts of the article appear to grab people's attention the most. And so on. Now, this is Giles Wilson on screen at the moment. He, in this blurb beside his photograph there, it says he's been a digital journalist since the very start of the BBC News website and introduced many of the features which become familiar to millions of daily readers. The growth of long-form digital journalism was Giles' passion, and he edited many landmark pieces for the corporation, and he's now a creative director of an independent organisation. And as we mentioned a second ago, he set up the Well Told conference, which Patrick Henningsen and I attended earlier this year, which ran the UK's first long-form and narrative journalism conference. And this was really the main feature of the Well Told conference. It was mainly BBC or ex-BBC people presenting at it, and they were pushing this idea of long-form journalism as being the most engaging type of journalism. I think we've known this for quite some time, Brian, but this is something which is now breaking into the mainstream as the way to engage an audience.
way to engage an audience. Well, I think something else is going on here, Mike. We've seen on the TV that they've been ramming through docudramas, so you're not too sure whether you're watching fact or fiction. And they are often, I would say, deliberately misleading in allowing the two things to drift through the play or whatever it is. Seems to me what we've got here is this moving across into the written word, albeit with lots of graphics. So we're not too sure whether it's fact or fiction. It's not we need facts, not fiction. It's we've just got to be sure where we draw the line. I think there's something exceptionally dangerous appearing here. And today we picked up on this story. This was the BBC headline page earlier this morning. And this was the story that caught my attention. It's about a missing RAF airman, 22 years old. It's a tragic case. He'd been out drinking. He disappeared. I think he's now considered to be dead, although no body's been found. But I was intrigued at the high prominence. You notice that it's got the little red tag on it. This is a very appealing image. So if you're looking at Theresa May, you don't want to see treason. You want to go to this other article. And when you click on it, it comes to this one. And the article is so long that the only way we could give you a look at it is create a little video at the page. And I think this is the one that starts. So if I play it, and you'll see the enormous amount of graphics talking about this man who's disappeared. Of course, many other people disappear, but we've got effectively page after page of a story being told, very flashy images, the nightclub that he went to, the fact that he used to play in graveyards as a little boy, one of his friends unfortunately killed under a train. It's all stitched together in what I found a very annoying graphic format, but it's not so much an article as a story. And the more you read, the more your mind begins to drift a bit as to whether you're reading fact or in fact fiction. Tragic bit of this case is there's a possibility that he drunkenly climbed into a waste bin to sleep off his night's drinking and was ultimately crushed, taken to a waste tip, left a pregnant girlfriend who's now given birth. So there's lots of emotion in this story, but the format is really quite bizarre. And you're not quite sure what you're reading. I'll do a little bit of more of this and we'll get David to come in and comment because he's been commenting on missing people. But at the end of the article, I think there's three what we would call clickbait articles. So you've gone through the missing man and then you get this. You might also like massacre. I found that particularly interesting way to put things. And massacre is about the shootings in Hungerford. Some time ago, that's all been revisited. We've got In Madeline's Shadow. We'll have a look at that in a minute. But here we've got another one, The Mystery of the Milk Carton Kids. I found that title interesting. I knew exactly what they were talking about. I found it interesting, but slightly offensive. Now, when you get into the article, you discover it's to do with missing people and missing children. It's very long. It's similar to The Missing Airman. Encourage people to go and have a look at it. But I quickly picked up on this, that the BBC was pushing statistics. According to the Centre for the Study of Missing Persons, most cases of missing children are resolved within 48 hours and only 1% of cases are open for more than 1 year. So the inference from the BBC is, well, we do get children missing, not to worry because it's all solved in 2 days and only 1% are any longer. So let's have a look at the questions around this. They put in another load of block data here, which they're also attributing to the missing persons, to the Centre for the Study of Missing Persons. And that correlates with data that we were reporting a little while ago. But let's have a look at how the BBC misleads the public, because they say that most cases are resolved within 48 hours. They're not talking about the cases that are not. Only 1% take a little longer than a year. You are left to believe to solve, where in fact we're looking at children where there's no solution to what's happened to these children. The BBC is misleading the public into believing the data is accurate when we know it's not. And of course, they're saying that only a tiny number of children disappear each year. So they go on to mislead people here in attributing the scent of a missing persons with this data. We spoke to the centre this morning, very helpful. We asked, was it their data? Instantly, the reply is no. It came from the National Crime Agency. And of course, in the last couple of days, we've reported that the most recent data from the National Crime Agency hasn't even been published because of errors. And we've also pointed out in existing documentation that there are a lot of caveats. Police databases don't tie up. But if you look at the basic figures, we said if you take 4% of the BBC figure that was being reported around the National Crime Agency figures, we're still looking for about 5,400 missing individuals. If a third are children, we're looking for about 1,800 children a year. So our question is, where are they, BBC?
Now, just to say that a third are children, that statistic, that came from somebody who was, when you spoke to them...
They were the children's lead for in the Association of Police...
Chief Police Officers. So yeah. you haven't made that third...
No, that's what a police officer gave me in a committee room in London when there was a talk about child abuse.
Yeah.
So it's a rough figure. It's only a rough figure, but roughly 33%. David, fascinating that the BBC homes in on this one disappearance case, makes a Corey story out of it, but the same BBC doesn't want to talk about other missing persons or children cases.
Yes, it's entertainment, isn't it? It's not journalism, it's entertainment, because it's principally there to stir emotions and not to inform or promote any action. There's no incentive for anyone reading that to get involved, to act, to personally stand up. And, of course, why pick that story? There are so many. Sean Ritchie, for example, who disappeared on Halloween some years ago in Peterhead and has never been seen since. In that case, the police are busy prosecuting his mother for allegedly wasting police time, something I personally do not believe, and allegedly making sort of false reports to highlight the case. I don't believe that either. And that's been she's now been threatened with all sorts of dire consequences unless she pleads guilty. The BBC are not covering that case.
No. When a mother fights for the fact that the police were not doing their job to look for her son who disappeared when there was very strong, at least anecdotal in some cases, evidence. People were saying he was murdered. The police don't investigate. BBC don't want to know about that case.
No, they don't want to know about that case. And remember what that case is. That the person on whose farm Sean was last seen, where he disappeared, is being prosecuted through the courts for an axe attack on another one of the party. And the police say these two things are not related. This is insane. But that's the position. But the BBC doesn't want to know about that.
And I'm going
to have to feel that these things are being selected to reassure, not to investigate.
I'm going to say, isn't it interesting that the BBC doesn't want to follow up on that investigation where the mother is saying that something's wrong? We stay on one case. I think you've got some comments here, Mike.
Now, look, David has said that what the BBC is presenting here looks like entertainment, that it's there to stir emotions. I'm going to add another thing into the mix here, because one of the issues that is being pushed on mainstream journalists with regard to long form narrative content is the ability to actually watch what people are looking at, what's grabbing people's attention. So in with these long form articles is some pretty clever analytics software, which is able to look at how long you spent on a particular part of the page, how far down the article did you read before you went elsewhere, which part of the page where they're making judgments on which part of the story were you actually interested in. And what they're doing is building a data set, a big data set, with this type of content. And so there may, in fact, be some psychological research aspect to this as well. And I think that's something that we've got to be aware of too.
Without doubt. And of course, we also know that the BBC, along with other mainstream media, is deeply concerned at the amount of information and articles that's coming across so-called social media. So, but there's something particularly sinister going on here. I deliberately use that word. What is the BBC up to? This is docudrama now coming through the printed word as well. Let's have a look at the clickbait they put about In Madeline's Shadow. I've labelled it Maddie docudrama. This is what it is. This is outrageous BBC reporting. I encourage people to go and have a look at this stuff. There's no proper investigative journalism into the case whatsoever. It is simply a regurgitation of the biggest and best headlines. The hype and blame is all put on to other press and press in particular, newspapers in particular. Everybody other than the BBC was to blame for the hype journalism around this case. They say there's a big headline embedded in the article, all that paedophile ring stuff. That really caught my eye. I think it was there to catch people's eye. And what it was doing was drifting into people's mind the idea that all of this talk about paedophile rings being involved in the Madeleine McCann disappearance, this is all nonsense. This is all ridiculous. So this is very dangerous journalism by the BBC. They admit there was heavy government involvement. I think Sherry Blair was mentioned. Gordon Brown, of course, was involved. Apologies for that little bit of extra text. But basically, they don't question the British government involvement. Why did the British government send out legal representation to this one case when many other parents get no help from the British government whatsoever? And, of course, the Portuguese police were insignificant, bungling idiots.
According to the BBC,
there is no proper comment on the concerns and the investigations by the Portuguese police. So this is a phenomenally biased article. And the BBC, of course, again, act as a media outlet for the Madeleine McCann parents, because nobody else's view is put forward at all. So if we can just pop that one off, I'll see what... if I just bring this back in on screen here, we've got the article for Corrie McKee. This is the first one of the missing RAF airmen. I just wanted to show you the size of the team that the BBC's put on it. I think that's seven editor authors altogether to produce this one article. This is something very special going on from the BBC. And I'm going to ask this key question. Is it the purpose of the BBC docudrama to steer public thought regarding missing children to the official line? And of course, the official line is nothing to see, no problem, only a few children go missing, and we solve that pretty quickly.
So let's just take this in a slightly different direction and look at how important the issue of child abuse is to the British government, who have announced that they're putting £600,000, not million pounds, £1,000, to four charities to help victims of child sexual abuse. This is going to be awarded to the National Association of People Abused in Childhood, to Barnardo's, to Rape Crisis England and Wales, and to Safe Line Warwick. The Home Office is really impressed with this. I'm not. It's not a huge amount of money at all.
It's not a huge amount of money. What this money is for is to help buy these people, because, of course, all the major charities are, in fact, government agencies by the funding streams. And if the government controls, if the government gives more money, the government control over the actions of these charities is even greater. So I think a lot of this is connected with the investigation into Ted Heath. The establishment is sweating over Chief Constable Mike Veal's report, and we're seeing a sort of preemptive strike by the media to confuse people, play down the subject of missing, abducted children and child abuse.
Boris, there's the delightful Boris, and the even more delightful Lady Lynn Forrester de Rothschild. They were hosting a meeting yesterday at the UN General Assembly on improving gender equality in the workplace. And how are they going to improve gender equality in the workplace? They're going to publish a register of companies and the percentage of personnel that they have employed that are male and the percentage of personnel that are employed that are female. And they're going to attempt to embarrass companies that have a female percentage, which is too small.
Yeah, I just want to say from this image, Mike, that clearly they're pushing their genders, respective genders, quite closely together, merging. But you notice that
Boris is in front.
Yeah, but that's because she's got her hand behind him pulling the strings.
Ah, right.
I mean, that's it. Puppet and puppet master.
Yes, I would have said so. Okay. We'll leave it at that point.
We'll leave it at that. Where do we go to now? Well, we have to go to you, David, because you've been tweeting out here. What have you got to say here? This is a debate about National Socialism.
Yes, this is why when people like Antifa are on the streets and they're shouting and yelling and wanting to beat people up and punch Nazis, and the definition of a Nazi that they have is whoever they happen to be punching at the time, they're wrong, or one of the reasons they're wrong. This is a debate between two people on the alt-right, right? One's called Vox Dei, who is essentially a libertarian, so he's arguing that what right means is respect for the individual, not collectivist, not communitarian, small government, etc. And one who is a writer or editor of the Daily Stormer, which is overtly neo-Nazi. Although I don't think he would actually accept that term. He thinks that's an abuse term, but it's not that inaccurate. And so this debate goes on about whether or not the Nazis, the National Socialism, is in fact left wing or right wing. Is it something of the state and it's left wing as Vox Dei argues, or is it defending the family and a few other things that the Daily Stormer editor argued? Now, for one thing, Vox Dei wins the debate hands down. But what's really interesting is as the debate goes on, it's an hour, but it's fascinating listening, and I really recommend people to try and seek this out.
And David, I'm going to cut in because I know that one of the things that you've been pushing very strongly over recent weeks is the fact that instead of people moving away from debating difficult, challenging, hate that word, but we know what it means, subjects, that people should get in and challenge and talk to other people who've got extreme views. We don't get anywhere by running away from the debate. We should be mixing it with them, because in the end, the better argument is going to prevail.
Absolutely. This is the point. So if you have a situation where someone has got a real case, a real concern, and that has drawn them to an extreme position, then debating and arguing can show a better way forward with that. If you have someone who's in an extreme position and they will not move, what the debate and argument does and what this does is reveal what that position really is, far more effectively than just yelling insults, right? So this debate shows what the Daily Stormer is all about. It reveals we talked about anti-Semitism no longer meaning what it used to mean. Well, that's true in many regards, but in this case, it's exactly what it used to mean. And they explore this and get an admission that there's blaming the Jews collectively for things that there are nothing to do with either the Jews as a whole or individual Jews. It's just a convenience for political purposes. And this is revealed. It's a fascinating insight into this sort of neo-Nazi side of thinking, where they're going, what they're doing. It's a danger and a threat that we should be aware of. And I'm very glad that I listened to this, very glad that Vox Dei took that on, took that debate on and argued for his view. And it shows the benefit of debate and of discussion, not violence and not just name calling.
Right, excellent. Now, one thing that you've also been pushing over many months is the fact that in Scotland we're seeing an increasingly draconian style of government coming in, particularly through the SNP. And we've got a series of articles here, which I'll just bring up on screen. Okay, this one here, we've got parents' attitude is stopping Scottish education becoming world class. We've got a teacher writing a furious open letter to Nicola Sturgeon saying that education in Scotland is utterly broken. And this one, I had to put a little subtitle in here. We've got SNP drive to get more poor children into university is backfiring on devalued pupils, according to an advisor. I had to put in relax, everything in the Scottish education garden is rosy. We've got draconian policies by the SNP ramrodding through named person, but also in the education process. What's happening here?
There's one that you might knit back to if you have a moment, the Scottish Review by Kenneth Roy. It's titled Curriculum of Fear, and it's talking about the violence in Scottish schools. I'll just give you an example of the areas he's covering. He writes here, he said, on 22nd of August, the 1,200 pupils of St. Kentigern's Academy, a Roman Catholic secondary in Blackburn, West Lothian, returned after a seven-week break. A week later, the school was the subject of a generally favourable inspection report from Education Scotland. Then last Friday, barely a month into the new term, a 14-year-old boy was slashed in the face with a kitchen knife, which had allegedly been brought into the school. A 13-year-old boy appeared in court yesterday, charged with assault to the severe injury and permanent disfigurement of the victim. Right? And he then explores what the report, what the government report into this was saying. I'll read you one paragraph. Short paragraph from the government report into the school in which this assault happened. The government inspector writes, although the vision, values and aims have a high profile across the school, there is scope for them to underpin development work and therefore have greater impact in the life and work of the school. As planned, the school community should work together to refresh the vision, values and aims to ensure full ownership. So the first question is, what does that mean? What does that mean? What do you think that paragraph means?
Well, we are going to have much more discussion on language. This is something that Dave Ellis has also been talking about, and Mark Anderson. We're on the clock for time. I'll just put this lady's face up on screen. I think we're going to save a bit of analysis on her for another time. But Naomi Eisenstadt is one of the key ladies helping the government form policy. And you obviously found her in your research. Just yes, a few seconds, David, because
Naomi is a globalist figure, ex-Cabinet Office, American Jewish, actually, educated in America, and she's the main advisor to end poverty in Scotland. And by the way, she knows nothing about economics. Just to finish off on the education, the Kenneth Roy article looks at the sort of figures. Taking the Edinburgh figures and making them typical for the whole of Scotland would give you an average of 74 assaults in Scottish schools per day. So he's saying there's a huge problem with violence and with bullying, and it's certainly what I'm hearing as well. The letter to Nicola Sturgeon from the teacher was talking about today, right now in schools across Scotland, teachers are losing morale on a scale I've never seen. So what I'm saying here is that there is a crisis in Scottish education. It's getting worse, and the top-down state-driven approach that is meant to be the cure is in fact the poison.
David, thank you very much for that. These are clearly areas that we've got to get into in a lot more detail. Protection of children, their education is our future, so we need to do that. Thank you very much for joining us. And I'm going to say thank you to our viewers and listeners. Thank you very much to our existing supporters. If you're new to UK Column and you're not yet a subscriber, please subscribe and or make a donation. We can only do what we do with your help and financial support. We'll be back same time on Monday. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.